Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You are listening to a talk as part of the Emerging Technologies Conference. This talk was recorded on the 25th of February 2011. Steph Gray, Director of Helpful Technology, opening keynote.
Well, thank you very much. And if you're worried talking about technology, I'm terrified talking to an audience of Scottish people for a start, but also social services people too, because that's really not my field at all. But I'll talk a bit more later about why I'm here, and I think hopefully what I can bring to this discussion today. So I called the session "How We Can Make Public Sector Organisations More Human," but I wanted to kind of kick off with a bit of a world tour through space and time. So bear with me. So let's step back a little bit and let's go down to Egypt last month. At the time of the revolution there that lasted a couple of weeks. And if you've followed some of this in the media, you'll have heard the important role that Facebook and social media generally played in that revolution. One of the Google employees in Egypt, a chap called Wael Ghanim, set up a page in response to the beating of someone who protested against the regime. And his page was called "We Are Khalid Said." And that quickly attracted a lot of people who wanted to protest. It also became more than just a page about one thing. It became a way of communicating more generally about what was going on in different parts of the country, about human rights in that country, and how to organize then a protest. And the interesting thing is it's not just what one person did. That site became a focus for other people's protests, and just a way of connecting up people who were within that country with other people who wanted to join them in that protest. If we step back a little further in time and move a little further south, we're now in Kenya in 2007. There have just been some presidential elections, hotly disputed, and the government were starting to effectively repress people in different parts of the country. But it wasn't a kind of a big battle in a square. It was lots of little suppressions all around the country. And a website was created called Ushahidi, which enabled people who were in their own communities, who didn't necessarily have particularly sophisticated phones or iPads or any kind of technology, really, just to give their testimony as eyewitnesses on the ground. So with a mobile phone, they could text in what they were seeing in their part of the country, and they could have it plotted on a map so that people outside could see what was going on, and actually follow the little individual examples of repression around a big country and take action about it. It wasn't journalists, it wasn't the government, and it wasn't even human rights organisations, it was individuals who were doing that. And let's come back home to the UK, and this is Westminster, incredible scenes just down the road from where I tend to work. This is just before Christmas, at the time of the student riots, the student protests. And, you know, students are pretty good with this stuff. And they were using, for example, tools like Twitter to communicate with each other when they're on the ground, to try and work out where the police were, to organise themselves, to move around the city. The famous example of them finding Prince Charles and Camilla in a side street. And really basically using the tools available to them, so whether it's phones, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Facebook, to organise protest and to communicate very, very quickly with each other so they know what's going on and what they can do in response to it. And then this is a nice story. This is what's going on right now in both the UK and in Zambia. There's a chap called Simon Berry, who's a very interesting person. He worked for many years as an aid worker in Zambia. And one of the things that struck him was that wherever you go in Zambia, in remote parts of Africa, you can always get a Coca-Cola. Doesn't matter where you go, you can always get a Coca-Cola. But you can't get important drugs, you can't get mosquito nets, you can't get lots of other things. So one of the things that Simon did, because he's very good with this technology himself, was to set up a campaign called Cola Life to create these things called aid pods. And you can see that little white cardboard box that's designed to fit between the necks of the bottles inside a Coca-Cola crate. And his vision was to harness that distribution network that Coca-Cola has in all these countries to distribute not just the Cokes, but also other important things, drugs, information, mosquito nets. And he's built that campaign through social media. So he now has a following of about 15,000 people, I think, on email and Facebook. He tweets, He's been blogging about his work. He's crossed over into the mainstream media. He's been on Radio 4's PM program, and I think he's really turned that campaign into something which is much bigger than you would normally be able to achieve as one individual. And he's now piloting this approach using these cardboard boxes in crates within Zambia with the help of Coca-Cola. But if all that sounds rather kind of grand and sophisticated, let's just sort of take a step back to, in this case, let's just say the 1613 to Teddington in South London, but it could be a train anywhere in any city in this country. Just imagine we're sitting on the seat on one side, and across from us, across the other side of the aisle, there's a couple of kids, maybe 14, 15, talking about what's going on at school, talking about what they want to do with their band, talking about what they're going to do tonight, talking about what they've seen on The X Factor last night. And you'll have heard this too. Every third word seems to be Facebook. They're talking about all the aspects of their life, but it all seems to come down to Facebook. And you start to realise that Facebook isn't just a website that they go and visit. It's not just something they go and check out, like a news site or something, every now and again. It's actually an extension to who they are, to their lives. And it's the way they organise themselves. And it, you know, even to someone who's relatively young like me, it's an incredibly different world. I can't imagine a connected network like that that continues beyond the limits of school or the limits of the kind of in-person interactions you have. But that actually that spreads, and that means you're connected to your friends and also to people who are bullying you, to your teachers potentially, to your the social services staff you work with. And that's the kind of relationship that continues 24/7. And let's just step back a little bit in time to last autumn. This is a chap called Mike, sitting in a local authority in Middlesbrough. And he's at his desk on the phone, but he's actually at a conference. He's at the Local by Social online conference organised by the Improvement and Development Agency. And what Mike's been doing is participating in a really innovative process where 1,300 people who work in local authorities up and down the country took part over 3 days in an online conference through a mixture of things like forums and blogs. And they talked about it on Twitter. They had roundups every day by email. None of it particularly cutting-edge stuff, technically. But what's cutting-edge was the fact that people like Mike didn't have to travel to some a big conference venue. They all did it from their desks. And the products of that conference, the discussions, the conversations, the people they meet and talk to, continue and live on online indefinitely. They can go back and find those slides and those contributions later. So what are the kind of trends we've seen in those different examples? Well, I think we've seen how tools like Facebook, like phones, like email and blogging and Twitter give individual people a voice. They give the ability to self-publish, to give the world your sense of what's going on in your part of it. And it's very much about having an individual identity. So you can actually tell people who you are, what's going on where you are, and actually build a profile and a sense of self online. But more importantly than just being able to publish, which we've been able to do for years, is actually the ability to connect with other people. And some of those networks might be enormous. They might be people who are looking to protest, to overthrow a dictator. It might be people who are looking to connect with their friends at school. It might be people who are looking to connect with people on a professional level who share an interest or share common problems, who are trying to navigate frameworks and standards. And also then the opportunity to share. So once you've cracked a problem, to share it with other people, perhaps to share the experience you've seen, to share, in the case of Egypt, video of someone being beaten in the street with the world, and to get other people then to comment and interact with that. So you can spread it, you can add values, you can add conversation, you can add more detail and information to it, and you can reuse it in your own materials. And I think that's where it's particularly valuable for kind of professional practice. You can put something out there, other people can find it, they can talk to you about it, and they can take what you've done and reuse it. So why am I here, being neither Scottish nor into social services? I'm not really that particularly specialist in e-learning either. I used to be a civil servant. I was amused to hear Anna talk about even the civil service gets this stuff, and it's true. Although I used to run the web team for the Department for Business, until last year, and we did the kind of things you'd expect a big government department in Whitehall to do. So we had a website, as you can see on top left, and we also had a SharePoint intranet. So yeah, we've gone from Egypt, the high hopes of Facebook in Egypt, down to a SharePoint intranet in just 10 minutes. So we did, you know, the kind of classic things you'd expect a government department to do. But we wanted to bring some of the ideas, some of the ambitions of social media and the social web into that kind of organisation, which is which basically depends on ideas, really, and connections. And we built our strategy on four things. We wanted to use these tools to listen to what our stakeholders and our audiences were saying. We wanted to be able to explain the kinds of things that the government was doing, to explain what lies behind the government's policy on digital or skills or higher education, and not just communicate to the normal audiences, but actually then to engage new audiences, whether it's young people themselves, whether it's individual businesses, whether it's people who are academics or have an interest in the policy itself, and actually to make it more of a two-way interaction. And I think the last step, convene, is one of those kind of grand words which social media people bandy around a lot. But for us, it just meant actually using the potential of a big corporate organisation with lots of stakeholders and lots of buildings and people and channels and events to actually get people to together and to use these tools to extend the reach and the conversation that happens in rooms like this, but to make it happen online too and to make it last longer effectively. So actually to work with some of the forums and to use the spaces that we had in more creative ways. So I'm going to show you a few examples of the kind of things we did, and also talk a bit about how you can get this kind of stuff done in a big corporate organisation. And this is these are good times, actually, to be trying to do these kinds of things in a public sector organisation. We are in times of austerity, but we're also in times where people are looking to try more innovative approaches to things, even in Whitehall. I think that if you look at what the Whitehall Westminster government is keen on at the moment, one of their key strands, are one is this idea of radical transparency. So everything that a big government organisation spends, what it pays its people, who its leaders are meeting, who it's contracting with in terms of suppliers, these kind of things are online and exposed to an army of armchair auditors. And that's one of the big strands. And it's where social media is good, because actually social media is all about exposing data, getting people to scrutinise things and talk about things. And the other side of it is decentralised tools and control. So the fact is that maybe this is a kind of grand way of describing what the government's talking about in terms of a big society. So trying to devolve the tools and control to people on the front line, to individual communities, so people actually make decisions at the chalk face rather than in kind of big central bureaucracies. And I think what we're all facing, as partly as a result of that, is porous organisational boundaries. So the kind of things that you say, used to say around the water cooler at lunch, and people now say on Twitter or on Facebook, and suddenly other people outside the organisation can pick that up. And you might find, you're probably finding this already, when people leave the organisation, previously it was kind of, you'd have a leaving do and say goodbye to them, but actually people kind of live on in your social networks forever, and that's a really useful asset. So I'm still connected to people from 3 or 4 jobs ago, and I get their help and their advice on things as and when I need it. It's almost like they never quite leave, in a good way, I think. And I think the other kind of enabler to a lot of this is lightweight and disposable platforms. So we've talked about things like Twitter and YouTube and Facebook, and the thing that they all have in common is that they're free. You can use those tools as a corporate organisation or as an individual, and you can use them for a bit, you can use them for a few months, or you can use them for years and years and create channels out of them. But the point is that they're disposable. We're not talking about investing tens of thousands of pounds in these new tools. So what are the kind of things that that we managed to do in a corporate organisation? Well, I mean, where a lot of people start and where we started as well was having some corporate social media channels. So this is, for example, a YouTube channel where we try to explain the work of a government department through video. So short, informal pieces of video, making the most out of the visits and the activities that our ministers were involved in. So just trying to extend the reach a little bit and to make it a little bit more engaging than just text. And corporate channels are great, but actually what I think I wish we'd done more of was actually getting our people to use these tools themselves. Marilyn is still an active tweeter. She works in one of our policy teams on science matters, science and kind of public engagement in science. And she's a nice model for how to use those tools as an individual within a big bureaucracy, effectively. She uses it to follow what stakeholders are saying. She uses it to interact with individuals, people she's working with on projects. She uses it very sensibly. She applies her common sense to what she's saying. And she's also very active in terms of what the organisation's saying. So she amplifies the kinds of things that the government department's official channels are putting out there and what ministers are saying. and actually helps it reach a bigger audience. So she's a very kind of tuned in, plugs in public servant. We also helped people to try and follow what was being said online about their policy areas and their organisations. So this is an example of a tool called NetVibes, which is, again, another free tool which you can use to create dashboards, and you can follow sources, all the kinds of different sources, and news sources, what's being said on blogs, what's being said on Twitter about your organisation. And it means that without this becoming an enormous time commitment, you can have this on your screen in the mornings and just have a sense of what's going on in your area. So we set these up for some of the policy teams working on particularly big consultations, so they could just track at a glance what was being said about the project out there on the interwebs. We also tried to kind of humanise and explain our consultations a bit more. So, you know, traditionally, we see the kind of consultations you can see on the left. So a screed of text, some PDF documents to download. And it's the kind of thing which people would engage with, who always engage with that kind of thing. People who are professionals, policy specialists, that kind of thing. But actually, we wanted to hear, in this case, from customers, from individual credit card customers, from people who've been ripped off by credit card firms. So we actually had to try a slightly different approach and use the tools of the social web a bit more creatively. So yes, we had some video, we actually commissioned a plain English version of this 100-page document that boiled it down into just 10. We had a podcast, we had a quiz, and we just tried to think a bit laterally about how we might engage a wider range of people with this kind of content. And I think what we were helped with a lot was the fact that one of our ministers, Lord Drayson, was very active in this stuff himself. So Lord Drayson was a very unusual kind of minister who was a racing car driver and a former entrepreneur. And he was very into his gadgets. I think he had iPhones kind of before all the rest of us did. And he was really addicted to his. And he had a tool on his phone called AudioBoo, which enabled him to basically record the conversations he was having with people and broadcast them online straight away. So it's all kind of like self-podcasting. Absolutely terrified the press officers because he could record this interview. He was chatting, and he was talking to an apprentice who was building satellites. And within a few seconds in the car home, he could have it online, including his comments on it. So he interviewed astronauts and all kinds of other people. And he was also very active on Twitter. And he used Twitter not just as a way of broadcasting what he was up to, the meetings he was having, that kind of thing, but actually inviting questions and feedback, taking on some of his critics. And I think he learned as he went, because he did get into hot water now and again. I think he tried to justify science spending in the budget in little individual 140-character messages. And, you know, he did well, considering. But it's that there are some things you can't do in that sort of format. But there are some things you can. And actually, you know, engaging your stakeholders, being responsive as a leader is a really good thing you can do through Twitter. And as well as using these kind of tools publicly, we also used them within our projects with our stakeholders too. So this is a tool called Huddle. Huddle, if you've come across it, is basically a project management tool, a web-based tool where you can create individual kind of workspaces for your different projects. And it means that people who aren't on your network, who can't access a shared drive or something, can still collaborate on documents together. So you can upload versions of files. Here you can see people are editing an agenda for a meeting. You can manage your tasks and discussions and all kinds of other things through that platform. Again, it's fairly low cost, and it's all held securely. You wouldn't want to put tax details, you want to put the individual case details on there, but you could certainly talk about the kind of, you know, documents around meetings, policy documents, that kind of thing. So really it's about using kind of those sort of platforms in a sensible way for the right kind of content. But the beauty of things like Huddle is that it avoids travel, it avoids meetings, and it gets people together who would never normally get together. And it just avoids the hassle of, you know, of a million different versions of a Word document flying around by email. And I talked about convening. I think this is one of the nicest examples of it. It's very easy for a big organisation, particularly a government department, to think that when it wants to do something, when it wants to create a campaign, it needs to go off and create a new Facebook page or a new microsite or something new. And actually, the point about social media is people are already talking in different places online. And actually, what you can do as a government department, the most efficient thing you can do is to go and identify those spaces and engage with them. So this is a fantastic forum called the Student Room, where I think we have something crazy like 28,000 forum posts every day from students up and down the country. There are forums for every university and subject. And when we wanted to engage mature students, we partnered with the Student Room and got them to create a space within their forums. And it was nice because, you know, unlike a traditional kind of marketing campaign where you'd have to go out and source case studies and record video and all this kind of stuff, the beauty of the student room was because it's a live forum, all we had to do was ask their members to tell their stories. And then what was built up is a bank of, I think, about nearly 200 case studies of people who've been mature students, who've come back to universities like this one, and actually talk about their experience, not just as a one-off, but actually to become live members of that community and able to answer questions on an ongoing basis. From our point of view, it was fantastic. We put a little bit of official information on our official channels. We spent a very small amount of money helping the student room to build this page. And what it meant was that we were much able to sort of serve our audiences in a much better way than we could have done if we'd sort of taken the traditional marketing approaches. So, what we've seen here, there are some interesting opportunities here. We can humanise these kind of big organisations. We can get ministers talking about what they're doing in a very human way. We can accelerate the pace of feedback and extend the reach of things. People are obviously surprised when they get a tweet back from a government organisation. And potentially there's the opportunity to economise. But, you know, it's not a free lunch. These things are often niche. Not just niche in the sense that they don't reach many people, but actually niche in the sense that there are lots of individual communities working. So, you know, Facebook is 500 million people around the world, but the fact that you have a Facebook page doesn't mean you reach 500 million people, sadly. What it does mean is you can reach lots and lots of professional niches and specialist niches using these tools. Social media can be volatile. People can take what you give them and spin it in a different way. And although a lot of these tools aren't new, actually how we use them is still quite experimental. People are still working through exactly what Facebook can be used for example. And obviously it's very highly scrutinized and it can be overblown. So one of the big problems actually is when you start to use these tools in a big corporate organization is everyone suddenly decides that this is fantastic and it'll be the solution to their incredibly tedious policy area. And they suddenly want to, you know, big all singing, all dancing consultations and Facebook pages for everything. And actually managing some of that demand, prioritising what works, is a really big challenge. Because actually, ultimately, this my boss did not look like this. My boss looked rather more like this. And I expect yours does too. And these people are not easily persuaded by some of this hype. And with good reason, to be honest, because these are some of the headlines that we managed to attract in our time. This was in the answer to a parliamentary question about how much time we spent managing Twitter. We published a Twitter policy, and you know we've been nice about it, trying to share it with other people. Government's big brother guide to using Twitter hit the headlines, and of course the Daily Mail. God bless the Daily Mail on all these matters. These things are real, and I think this is where applying not just common sense, but also a little bit of sense about. Will this hit the Daily Record? Will the Daily Mail want to pick this up? Is this the kind of thing that can be spun as civil service waste? Is always worth having at the back of your mind. And these are some of the things which we heard internally as well. So as well as the external pressure, we also heard some of these kind of comments from people inside. So people talk about there being no point, about it being too risky. About policy teams becoming overwhelmed by these kind of things. People saying it's a luxury we can't afford. We're too busy to do this kind of thing. We're supposed to be in times of austerity. Why are we tweeting? I wouldn't know where to start with some of this stuff. And ultimately, you know, whose job is it to do it? Is it a digital team's job? Is it everyone's job? We've tried this kind of thing, and it doesn't work, to be honest. We didn't get enough responses. And the interesting one, the killer one at the end, you'll never get it past IT. I think a few people have heard that one. And the thing is, there are answers to all of these questions. And actually, Breeder and I from Learning Pool are going to be running a session in here during the workshops. And we're going to try and tackle some of these kind of the reasons to say no and what you can do within your organisations to actually convince people and to manage some of those risks sensibly. Because there are good answers to all of those. And ultimately, what we kind of found was that there's a bit of an evolution that people go through in terms of using these tools. I think the building blocks of it are the importance of building awareness. People know what these things are, that they have interest in using them, and then they can sort of relate a tool to an opportunity in their work. So it's one thing to see people protesting using Facebook in Egypt. What does that mean for the training course I'm running next week? And what are the parallels? I think once people have got to that level where they're starting to think, okay, well, this is something I could use. I know what these tools are about. I'm interested in using them. Then you hit these barriers of access. So can I use the tools? And then do I have the kind of the skills? Do I have guidance and policies that enable me to actually use them well? And ultimately, when you get to that stage, who can I learn from? So who can I kind of share my experiences with, and who can I hear from in similar organisations who've been through this too? And you need to kind of take people on this kind of journey from having limited awareness about what these tools are, right through to not only doing it themselves, doing it well, but actually sharing and contributing to a community. And there are some really vibrant communities, not only in Scotland, but around the country, of people who are in the public sector who are using these tools in interesting ways, and who are very good at kind of mutual support, both at events and also online. So I'm just going to leave you with sort of four general conclusions. And one is, I think one of the most important ones is to be sensible about the risks but not scared of them. We go out when it rains, we just take an umbrella. And it's the same with technology and social media. There are risks, obviously, things could go wrong. We need to manage them. We need to tell people not to put sensitive information on Facebook. We need to use moderation tools well to kind of prevent people from putting abuse on official channels. But we shouldn't be scared of those things. We can manage those things. And part of that is about being very clear and being very open about what the constraints are on the organisation and what it can do. So whether that's your own people, whether it's writing policies, trusting your own people on the front line, trusting your own trainers and staff to use these tools well themselves, or whether it's trusting your customers. And actually, we found a lot of people were very concerned about what people would say when we started to run a consultation online and allow comments publicly. But actually, the more focused you make it, the more people you treat people as grown-ups on the outside, the more they respond as grown-ups, the more they engage on that level. And I think we touched on the fact that these things are free, and I think that's an important part of this. We are in times when there aren't great budgets around, and this is a really good time, therefore, to use some of these lightweight tools and to call things pilots. I mean, call things... You know, the fact we're using Facebook for a project doesn't mean we're always going to use Facebook for projects, doesn't mean we're going to stop having meetings, doesn't mean we're going to cut out all email, but we can pilot these things and see how they go. And we could also be honest about the feedback. So we can say that things don't work, we can try channels, and if they go bust, because .com things go bust all the time, we can say that was the experiment that worked or didn't work, and we can move on to something else. And I think that the last point, and really the killer for me, is that it's very easy to get hung up when you use things like Facebook and Twitter as a corporate organisation on how many people are on my page, how many comments have I had, how many people are retweeting the kind of things I've been saying, what's my reach. And the private sector gets very excited about this stuff too. But actually, the real value, particularly for public sector organisations, is not in the numbers, it's in the conversation and the discussion. And this is the same is true of events. You know, you can listen to people like me on a podium, but actually a lot of the value of it is in the conversations in the hallways. This is an event called UK GovCamp, which we held in London recently, which was 200 people from around the public sector talking about how technology can help the public sector in different ways. And actually, it's what's called an unconference. People don't have pre-planned sessions that they meet in the corridors, and they propose sessions themselves, and they talk about what they want to talk about. It's a really interesting way to get people to connect and discuss. And I think the lesson of that is it's not just about the event, it's also about what happens afterwards and around it through technology, and technology can support what happens in a physical place with discussions around it. Thank you very much. And that's me if you want to get in touch.